Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning into The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Troubled by all the tariff talk, what could that mean for local businesses that rely on goods from foreign countries? Looking down the barrel of double-digit hikes, we turn our eye to fashion and flowers. What's the snapshot for imported flowers? May's a month of weddings, graduations, and yes, a reminder, Mother's Day is almost upon us. And Hawaii's designers are busy at the Merry Monarch Festival today, but they are already planning for their fall lines. How will tariffs affect them? And are you relying on tax credits to install those solar panels? The state legislature eyes some changes to the program. And on today's Mono Minute, we meet an introduced bird to Hawaii with a sorrowful call. And we highlight an Easter egg surprise from a bird species that has not been seen in the wild for decades. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Monty Pereira knows flowers. He's been in the business for nearly three decades. The general manager and sales and marketing director at Watanabe Floral stopped by our studios this morning and spoke with The Conversation's D.W. Gibson. Here's what you need to know about how the threat of tariffs might be affecting the price you will pay for flowers as the industry enters its busiest month out of the year.
You know, I don't think many people realize, especially here in Hawaii, because we have so much foliage and so many flowers that people just assume that most of the flowers are from locally grown sources, but that's not the case. 88% of the flowers in the country, including in Hawaii, are imported, predominantly from South America. You know, so we get most of our flowers from Colombia and Ecuador. You also have a lot of flowers that are grown in Mexico and Canada. And then a ton of flowers come in from Asia, mainly the orchids and orchid-based lei products. So it has had a tremendous impact in a short amount of time.
88%, that's a high number. So that holds for the continent as well as Hawaii. We are on par with the continent.
Absolutely. Yep, definitely. In fact, maybe even higher because we don't have the access to Canada as much as some of the people in the Pacific Northwest and California does, or from Mexico where they're just driving over the borders. We tend to get everything, well, we have to get everything flown in. So that usually enters the country through Miami and then flies to Hawaii. So I would think our percentages maybe even slightly a tick higher.
And you mentioned some of those popular lei flowers coming from Asia. Dial down a little bit there. What varietals are most at risk in terms of being affected by the tariffs?
So I think from a cut flower perspective, I think the flowers that most people are very aware of that are being impacted are things like roses, which are coming from Colombia and Ecuador. Similarly, things like carnations and chrysanthemum pom-poms of popular flower, especially for Memorial Day or grave or to take to the graveyards. So those are the cut flowers that are going to be mostly impacted that I think people are aware of. On the lei side, you know, all the orchid lei that you see here in Hawaii, whether it be the single orchid lei that all tourists get or the more fancy types like the Christina lei that Governor Lingle used to wear every single day, those are all coming from Asia, you know, predominantly Thailand. And so when the tariffs first came out, it was that flat 10% across the board. So that was a little bit easier to plan for. But then Thailand was threatened with an additional 54%. That would have seen lei prices, you know, skyrocket right before the 1 month of the year where there's a lei occasion after lei occasion after lei occasion. So fortunately, that reciprocal portion of the tariff went away. So right, what we're dealing with right now is about a 16, 17% tariff from Thailand and around 10 to 16% from Colombia and Ecuador.
Yeah, it can be dizzying trying to keep track of where the tariffs actually are at any given point. At this juncture, have you noticed real-time changes in terms of, let's say, inventory that's available to you?
You know, from a supply standpoint, there hasn't been really a change. You know, so as soon as the tariffs were announced, of course, you got notices coming from the farms and the suppliers saying that, hey, prices are going to have to go up. But one of the beauties, I think in any industry, but certainly I can speak for the floral industry as a whole, is that there's been a real concerted effort from the farm all the way through to the end user to everyone just kind of absorb a little bit so that the consumer is not bearing the full burden of price increases. I think in the floral industry, we have a very keen recognition that we're not a necessity. People need to eat. They need to have clothing and housing. You don't need flowers. As much as we want to think everyone needs flowers, you don't. So you can't just say flippantly, we're getting hit with a 17% tariff. We're going to raise all of our prices by 17%. It just doesn't really work that way. So everyone is doing all they can to minimize the impact on the end user, especially before the month of May, which for Watanabe Floral and for all floral shops here in Hawaii especially is about 50% busier than any other month, including Valentine's Day, February.
Yeah, we like to focus on that Valentine's Day, but it's sort of a holy trifecta here in Hawaii between May Day and graduations and Mother's Day. And
yeah, so for Valentine's Day, it's like it's really busy for that 1 week. And then, you know, you can kind of get a breather. Once it turns the month of May, you have May Day, then you have Mother's Day, then you have the university system graduating, then the high school's graduating, then you wrap up with Memorial Day. And those are three of the five busiest holidays in the year, all in back-to-back weeks in the month of May. So we're glad that the tariff, as much as it's been a pain to deal with all of this, at least it happened to give us a one-month time to adjust, to prepare, and to try to find a way to make sure that the consumers can still enjoy all of these holidays going forward and not have to really worry about price being detriment or hindrance to them in being able to enjoy Mother's Day or any other occasion.
Are there any other concentric circles of consequences that you see in terms of pricing? I'm thinking in terms of even vases and containers we might put flowers in and packaging.
Oh, definitely. I think packaging, you know, you're seeing that. You actually saw that from Trump's first time in office when he went after China. So I think there's been some preparation in terms of moving some of the production of vases, especially those glass vases, back to America. So there has been more production and manufacturing of vases here within the United States. Although in Hawaii, we are still getting the majority of our stuff from China. So with 145% tariff, eventually, if this doesn't go away, you're going to start to see significant increases in things like vases that you kind of take for granted that you can pick up a vase for, say, $2, $3. Those may be more like $7.50 to $10. But for now, I think because it's not a perishable item, there was a lot of storage that took place in anticipation of President Trump coming into office that we don't anticipate it being a factor for the next 3 to 6 months. But if it continues beyond, say, the holidays, then you're going to see significant increases in the cost of hard goods.
You mentioned people at different points in the industry sort of working together to keep prices down as much as possible. Is there any other way that this is affecting your business model, your approach to the work that you do?
It's kind of like 5 years ago, we were hit with COVID and everyone had to just kind of pivot and scramble. And this kind of feels like COVID in a little bit of a different way. If these costs continue to stay at these levels and this doesn't go away, then it is going to have to change the model. You know, we're going to have to kind of adjust what we have to be able to provide something to the consumer at a price that they can afford. So, for example, maybe it'll be featuring more half dozen rose arrangements instead of just dozen rose arrangements. Or even for like today's Professional Administrators Day, you know, having bud vases instead of full arrangements. So you kind of adjust maybe what the width of what your offerings are typically to make sure that you're still affordable and still an option for everyone.
And that's interesting to hear about COVID as sort of a precedent of some kind of roadmap in terms of a major disruption. It sounds like in some strange way that might be helpful to these circumstances.
In a very strange way. I mean, there was nothing quite like COVID. But I think for many of the companies that were able to survive, it really forced you to be as efficient and really make keen decisions on how you do things. And I think that's one of the things that we're dealing with right now, as well as all the others that have a tariff impact. One way to overcome that is to cut costs. And so, unfortunately, you're kind of seeing some of that already with some companies laying off people in anticipation of things slowing down. Fortunately for us, we're headed into our busiest month of the year, and we don't expect really volume to change during the month of May because those holidays, especially here in Hawaii, there's such a cultural impact with anything to do with lei and graduation and May Day that we don't expect volume to change. So we're not laying off people or cutting costs at all right now. But again, if this is something that continues indefinitely, that's going to be something that all businesses are going to have to take a look at. How do you compensate for lower revenue? And the only way to do that is to reduce costs.
And you said supply is strong now, but I suppose if this were to carry on for a while, we could see issues there in terms of supply coming into the country.
Definitely. And I think it's just too soon now, so we're not expecting that. We're not hearing about anything in regards to Mother's Day, but we are hearing at farm level, you know, so if you're a farm in Colombia and you have an opportunity to sell your product to Europe with no tariff or to Asia with no tariff or to America and pay a tariff, you may opt to send it to Europe instead. So that is a possibility that we're certainly monitoring. When most of the production in America ceased and it over the last 25, 30 years, because of how prevalent it was coming from South America, America is not prepared to re-ramp up the farms, the floral farms. That's just not something that can happen, you know, overnight. So there is a definite concern that we don't want to price ourselves out of the market where these farms in Colombia say, hey, I'm not going to deal with the tariffs. I'll just send my stuff somewhere else.
Any other dynamics in terms of tariffs and how it's affecting the flower industry that I haven't asked about that you think it's important to get to listeners?
I just think there's a realization that, you know, everything, you kind of don't realize how dependent you are on the rest of the world for everything that we deal with on a daily basis, whether it be food, flowers, vases, or anything else. And I think something like this really starts to get you to understand what can we do, how can we pivot, how can we support local farmers here in Hawaii so that they can produce more of the floral product or more of the food product so that we can be a little bit more self-sustaining. I think things like this really bring that to light. And that's something that we're kind of hopeful that our local governments will take seriously and provide that support and that ramp up to allow more self-sustainable actions here in Hawaii.
With that in mind, maybe ending on a positive note, do you want to highlight a few flowers that we should be aware of that are local that we can keep an eye out for and support local growers?
Well, most of the tropical flowers are still grown locally, although some of them have to be imported because, again, I think we were growers for the first 68 years at Watanabe Floral. Since from 1945 till 2008, we actually were local growers, but we just could not compete in the marketplace because of the, you know, the international growing. And there are so many farms that have gone that direction, whether they can't compete or once you get to the third, fourth generations, there's not a whole lot of them that want to work on a farm. So you have less and less and less local productivity. So it's just a matter of how can we change that culture? How can we make it something that our young people want to do? And then we're hopeful that this may be the catalyst that kind of forces us in that direction.
Fascinating, fascinating point. It seems to parallel some of the stories we hear out of the Midwest of people manufacturing, working in factories for years, and younger generations moving away, moving on to other work because of global dynamics. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective today, Monty. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
That was HPR's D.W. Gibson speaking with Monty Pereira from Watanabe Floral about how tariffs may affect flower prices.
Support for HPR comes from Ulupono Initiative. By investing and partnering in local food production, Ulupono supports Hawaii's farmers and ranchers who help reduce the risk of wildfires through land management and stewardship.
If you've got fresh ideas on how HPR can best serve our islands, apply to join our Community Advisory Board. We're looking for people from all islands. The feedback from our volunteer board helps us shape our programming and events. Apply by May 16th at hawaiipublicradio.org/CAB.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
We just heard about flowers, but tariffs may start to take their toll on the fashion industry. Today is when many designers are front and center at the Mary Monarch Hawaiian Arts and Crafts Fair. But those popular islandware brands like Manoʻola, Manuhealiʻi, and the like are made overseas in places like China, Bali, Vietnam, Indonesia, and India, which are all looking at tariff hikes. This morning, we talked to Georgia Skinner of the state's Creative Industries Division about the uncertainty around higher prices.
The design and apparel industry in the state, as well as jewelry, are so important to us. And we have had some outreach from particular designers as well. The tariffs have an impact not only on the production of their work, meaning textile design and anything they're getting printed in the countries that are now having tariffs imposed by the United States, but also it's the buttons. It's the zippers. It's the other things that they may order, which may also be affected and raised in price. Our foreign trade zone, headed by David Sakink, you know, is very active in this area about the tariffs because the zone does house some other designers and people that are manufacturing products here in the state. They get components from these countries as well. So even hard goods, not just fashion, but hard goods for ukulele construction, for example, if they're being done here, but they need other woods to do so, all of that is affected.
Well, I know when I talk with Kenny Zamora, you know, and, you know, he made his big splash on Project Runway, right, with Jay and Ari South, and they really got things going. You know, they got their start over at Honolulu Community College under Joy, the fashion technology director there at the time. And it's just been wonderful to see what has blossomed over the last 10 years. I remember when Kenny bought he invested in a machine that did embroidery, you know, so he could do fern. And yet not everybody can afford to invest that kind of money in equipment.
No. And I think, you know, what you bring up an amazing point, Catherine, and it's this, that we at DBED have been highly focused since last year on what is it going to take for our fashion and design industries to level up, to really mature in a way that sustains them. And we've come up with a methodology that's going to include not only training at an early level, but in partnership with Honolulu Community College and others to really develop the ability to silkscreen here, sublimation printing, direct to substrate printing, and even sewing and embroidery stations, as you mentioned, because we need a facility that would house all that and make it available for not only the up-and-coming designers, but also for the established designers.
Right now, we have some, you know, retail stores, brick-and-mortar stores. We have, you know, online sales. Designers are doing pop-ups, you know, at the Mary Monarch. But I know that there's some thought, like, oh, do we open up a place on the continent to kind of expand their reach?
Mm-hmm. Any fashion hub on the continent is a likely target for, as this evolves, to be able to market the existing designers that we have here in such a way, in the right kind of space, with the right kind of aesthetic and honoring the traditions of the cultures here, to be able to showcase that, particularly, you know, with the great exposure that a lot of our designers, Manoʻola, Kini, others, Hawaii Island designers, who have been at New York Fashion Week. But then what happens after that? And I think it's a responsibility of the state to look at the value proposition of this industry and why this, as well as music, is so important to really develop in a way that we can take them from incubation to maturity.
Well, you know, as I was popping into the different stores at Pearl Ridge the other day and just talking with the staff, you know, and they're like, yeah, we get our items from Bali, Indonesia, from China, and you know, they are already planning for the fall line. And so it's so crazy with all this uncertainty. And I know Kenny had said, well, he hopes to know in another month, you know, how he's going to be affected. But that certainly does affect the bottom line.
It definitely affects the bottom line. And I think even with some designers, as you mentioned, also going not just in the foreign countries, but to the continent, in regions there for maybe silkscreen printing or other things that are necessary for them to transfer their designs onto fabric and then cut and sew here. Those things are of primary importance to us, and we're going to be doing everything we can to look at our congressional delegation, how they can help us to ensure that if the tariffs do come, what kind of relief are we going to be able to give our fashion and design industries? And I think you also might want to think about talking to Jaylene from NoHo Home, because as a textile designer, she has her own micro factory. But even that is not going to change the need for some of this to be done offshore. Hawaii has long looked at this idea of a manufacturing hub, and in today's market with this imposition of the tariffs, you know, what does that universe look like? And I think this idea of having a creative and innovation hub here in Oahu and possibly small satellites around the state on other neighbor islands as well, it's impacting the entire industry. So how can we jump in and help? So hopefully we can do a follow-up with you to kind of let you know where DBET is on the research in terms of creative industries and where we're looking to provide some relief, provide some advocacy to make sure that we're not adversely impacting something that has the potential, as you and I mentioned yesterday. This industry, fashion design in particular, including jewelry design, is something that has reached, I think, a very strong midpoint. And careers and the kind of work that you're seeing is almost a flashback to when the early designs of the 50s and the designers at that time made, and they now are legacy companies here. They're not in a very solid situation either. You know, they also rely on the production line to be able to meet their needs in ready to wear.
Yeah, and you know, there were basically small kind businesses that were actually, you know, sewing the garments here, right? And some of that is still done, but most of it is outsourced, I think.
A lot of the cottage industry, whether it's in Kalihi or the round robin of several designers hooying up to share a group of sewers, is something that I think is important. I know that during our work in the last year and continuing this year in creative sector job development as part of the Good Jobs Hawaii Challenge, Tori Richards and others have been at the table to actually look at how do we create more of those skills, because it's not as exciting as being a designer, but it sure is necessary for us to thrive as our own hub in the Pacific to be able to do this.
Well, was there anything proposed this session that might have given these small businesses a leg up?
In the 2024 session, our legislature did pass a concurrent resolution, HCR 184, and our team, headed by Tracy Young and Thomas Chalk, worked very closely with industry, specifically Keola Raposo, Jaylene, Keola Raposo, and Summer Shigii, to really lead as a convener to get input from the industry. So what we have now is a template of industry input in design and fashion that we can now do a blueprint for what that means to grow these industries. And the components of having production lines be able to be supported where state and federal dollars perhaps are sponsoring and supporting not only the build of the facility, but all of the tools necessary and the ability to expand silkscreen printing, have a sublimation printer, things that tie directly back and are integrated from what you're already learning at Honolulu Community College. And after that, you go to our Creative Innovation Center, and that would be a place where you could start your business. You get the wraparound services. You would be able to have access to the same kind of equipment that you had at HCC, but now to use to launch your business without having to invest the capital.
Well, I think, you know, these tariffs are certainly a setback to those plans to move ahead, but we'll just have to wait and see over this next month to see how this plays out.
Yeah, exactly right.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Georgia. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome. I hope it helps.
And that was Georgia Skinner, head of the Creative Industries Division in the State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism, talking to us about the challenges that the tariffs present to our fashion industry. You know, we went back out to hear from some of you about how inflation and the economy are affecting your shopping experience. The Conversation's G.W. Gibson recently met Josh from Kaneohe outside of Costco, and the conversation soon turned to how tariffs threaten Josh's line of work. He started by telling us of some of the challenges of keeping a young athlete fed. So what's in his cart?
We got a lot of vegetables and produce today. So my daughter is a student athlete. She's a water polo player, so she's constantly moving and constantly swimming and wrestling and fighting. So it's a combination of swimming, wrestling, and hockey. But you know, there's an element of drowning. So she's always working out and trying to be as physical and healthy as possible. So her big thing that she's passionate about now is meal prep. So all of this is built around meal prep. So greens. She basically picked everything out here. The asparagus, the Brussels sprouts, the salmon, all that stuff's for her. Got some tofu for me. But yeah, it's basically meal prep for her. That's what the Ziploc bags are for.
It can be dangerous if your kids are picking out all this stuff and throw it in their cart. It adds up.
It does add up, but it's all vegetables, so I don't feel bad about it. It wasn't like she was going through the candy aisle and just filling it up to the top. So when your daughter comes to you and says, hey, can I get some asparagus? Sure. You know, who's going to say no to that?
So do you usually do most of your shopping here at Costco?
On occasion. We come here about once a month.
Well, so in the last couple of times you've gone shopping here or other places, last few months, have you noticed changes in prices of goods?
I've noticed some changes, yeah. I usually shop either here or at Foodland, but I usually try to get, you know, whatever's on sale or the little Mackay card thing at Foodland, whatever. And then at Foodland, they do a thing at the hot bar and at the one at Foodland Farms where it's half off everything on Fridays. So that's a popular one. We go there for breakfast and dinner sometimes, just because it's a good deal on prepared food. So seeing it here at the grocery store, but seeing a lot more at the restaurants. The restaurants, it's much more expensive to eat out than it was a year ago. So, yeah.
Do you feel like that's changed your habits at all or still continue the same?
It's changed our habits a little bit. You know, we used to go out to dinner all the time as a family, and now we eat a lot of food at home as a family. So we prepare a lot of meals, you know, i.e. all this meal prep that she's got here. You know, we used to get school lunch and all that. That was expensive. So again, she's doing the meal prep. So yeah, it's changed some of our habits.
Well, I don't know how closely you watch headlines, but are you anticipating any changes with sort of talks of tariffs and so forth?
So the business I'm in, we're very focused on the tariffs. I work in a renewable energy business, so we do a lot of solar, biofuel, biomass. So a lot of those components come from China. Right now, we're at 145% on Chinese goods, and China raised their import duty on our stuff to 125%. So a lot of the things that we import and bring in and work with come from Asia, come from China. And so that's, we're seeing a big bite there, and we can't forecast pricing. It's been real hairy right now with the tariffs.
So how are you and your colleagues dealing with that uncertainty?
Well, we're trying to price it in with our customers, but they don't really like the uncertainty either. You know, it's a classic game of, you know, where do I take this risk? Do I take it to the customer? Or are we going to absorb it? Are we going to take lower margins? We're still trying to figure all that out. We had to have some difficult conversations last week with some customers about some stuff that we were planning to do. And it was like, this is much more expensive now. And they said, no, we're not going to do it. So, yeah, that's the reality we're in right now. You can get solar panels in Africa. You can get solar panels in Europe. But the hard part is the inverter, the thing that takes the power off of the solar panel and turns it into electricity you can use at home. And a lot of those components, even though they may be manufactured in the U.S., parts of it are coming from China. So that's the hard part where everyone's trying to price in right now is this component, you know, how much does that affect the overall price of the unit? And people are still figuring that out. It's hard.
That was HBR's D.W. Gibson, who spoke with Josh just outside of Costco recently. How's the state of economy affecting your shopping habits? What's in your shopping cart and what's on your mind? Where should we go next to talk to folks? Leave us a voicemail, 808-792-8217, or email us, talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
This Sunday, Hawaii Public Radio brings you a performance from our Live from the Atherton Mele Hawaii series. Enjoy music from the Malie Lyman Quartet. Join us for Live from the Atherton with the Malie Lyman Quartet Sunday at 4 p.m. on HPR1. sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. On view now, Satoru Abe Reaching for the Sun, featuring 70 years of the Hawaii artist's paintings, sculptures, drawings, and prints. HonoluluMuseum.org.
The solar industry is being challenged on the global scene, as we just heard, as well as on the local scene. State lawmakers were scheduled to take up a couple of bills today that have to do with solar credits. HPR's Savannah Harriman-Poten has been tracking the legislation in these waning days of the legislative session. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what's the latest?
Yes, so the latest is the two bills that I wanted to come on the show and talk about today, House Bill 1369 and House Bill 796, actually were just advanced right before we got on the phone by the Conference Committee of House and Senate members. And so these are big bills about income tax credits, but I've just been tracking them very narrowly to look at what they mean for the renewable energy tax credit. And that's a tax break that individuals and companies get for installing renewable power. Listeners will probably be familiar with it if they've ever gotten rooftop solar, for instance, on their home. And House Representative and Finance Chair Kyle Yamashita introduced the first of those, House Bill 1369. And it originally had this language in it that would have rescinded the renewable energy tax credit outright. That got a lot of pushback. And it was removed, that language was removed from the bill, but Yamashita said this during an earlier finance committee this legislative session.
At some point in time, I have asked the solar industry in particular, every market as it matures, there has to be an exit to subsidy. Nobody's been able to answer, give me the answer to that question, when is it time? Because if you don't exit, then there is market distortion.
So what did the solar folks have to say about that?
So I spoke with Rocky Mold. He's the head of the Hawaii Solar Energy Association. And as you might have guessed, the solar industry was among those opposing the language in that bill. And they emphasized the importance of tax credits, especially in light of the state's renewable goals. So he thinks that achieving 100% renewable energy by 2045, this big goal that Hawaii has set for itself, would be really difficult if we took away this incentive for folks to install rooftop solar. But he's open to the conversation about sunsetting the credit. He said one suggestion he had was to peg it to the state's green goals so that we could phase out the credit when we hit our renewable portfolio standard end goal, or maybe in 2045, whatever comes sooner. But lawmakers have a different timeline, possibly. So enter House Bill 796, the other bill I mentioned at the top. That was also proposed by Yamashita, and that would set a five-year deadline to end state income tax credits broadly, with just a few exceptions. And this bill was originally only going to apply to new and renewed credits, but it was amended to apply to existing credits, which looped in the renewable energy credit. And I spoke with Mold yesterday, asking him how he felt about this language and what he wanted to hear from the committee members. And he says that if the bill became law with that language, the solar industry would be looking at a sledgehammer, essentially, in 5 years that would immediately change their business outlook. And yesterday when we spoke, he was hoping that today he would hear from lawmakers why they felt strongly about this timeline.
I'd like to hear the rationale for the approach that they're taking. First of all, I'd like to understand where this is coming from, but also I'd like to hear, you know, voices that are standing up for the solar tax credit and standing up for tax expenditures and tax credits as policy apparatus for our state to achieve critical goals. I mean, these income tax credits are there because they support critical policy goals, including our renewable energy goals. And I just hope there's a voice in there that is understanding the strength of tax expenditures and tax policies to achieve critical public policy goals.
So what did they come up with ultimately?
Yes, so I reached out to Yamashita to talk about these bills beforehand, but they didn't respond ahead of the committee. So I was listening in on this committee hearing, truly just half an hour ago, and they decided to advance the Senate version of 796, which keeps in the language about all existing credits. And the rationale that Yamashita gave was that this 5 years would give the legislature time to review economic tax credits to see if they're actually serving their purpose, getting the outcomes that lawmakers want. And then in that 5 years, they can decide whether or not they want to rescind, extend, or modify these types of credits. But part of the reason why this is frustrating for the solar industry right now to have this tax credit reexamined is, as we heard in that conversation just a couple of minutes ago, the solar industry is dealing with a lot of pressure outside of Hawaii. So Will Giese said it's like fighting a war on two fronts. He's with Solar Ray, which is based in Hawaii, but also does business on the continent. And he says tariffs are really driving up prices for his business. And he, like many in the industry, is worried that Republican-led efforts to shrink the national budget will put other solar tax credits on the chopping block. For instance, Solar Ray got a significant tax credit recently, which is funded by the Inflation Reduction Act. And that was to help build the first solar panel recycling plant in Hawaii.
We qualified for a pretty sizable tax credit to do manufacturing, or in our case, recycling in Hawaii. If that were to suddenly go away, you know, we would be out tens of millions of dollars in sunk costs because of that, and the rug would be pulled out from under us. And we are trying to build something that would recycle modules and then become essentially a producer of critical materials, things like silicon, aluminum, glass. You know, I don't know how much critical materials Hawaii produces these days, but I can tell you that it's not that much, right? So for that to be removed from us, not only would that impact our business, but that impacts the ability of the United States to produce those materials and to have a manufacturing facility.
Yeah, and that whole recycling bit, I mean, that's important, right? Because we've got so many panels that are aging, and what do you do with it? We don't have a lot of space in the landfill.
Yeah, so Solar Ray and Inner Island Solar was looking at building this recycling plant because they've seen increasing demand for the recycling for solar plants. And they have 4 years on which to use this credit. So theoretically, they should have a good amount of time in order to get that manufacturing plant up and running. But they're concerned that the credit could be taken away sooner rather than later. And as you said, they would really be left in the lurch if that were to happen.
Yeah, well, we'll have to keep our fingers crossed. But yeah, lots in play right now. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote, who has been tracking solar legislation this session. You can look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. On today's Manu Minute, we have the call of the mourning dove, which, like other doves, is considered a symbol of peace. The recordings you'll hear are courtesy of Zeno Canto. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Biology Professor Patrick Hart.
Mourning doves are the rarest and hardest to find of the four dove species that have been introduced to Hawaii. They're about a foot long, light brown above with a wash of pink, and are the only dove in Hawaii with big oblong black spots on their wings. Their name comes from the slow, mournful calls they make and that are very unique. Originally from the western part of North America, they were introduced to Pu'uva'ava'a on the Big Island in the mid-1960s as a game bird, and are now fairly common in the dry woodlands and grasslands of North Kona and South Kohala. They can also be found in low numbers on most of the other islands across Hawaii, indicating they may be able to fly between the islands. Like many other doves, they primarily eat seeds from a variety of non-native shrubs and grasses. Also, like other doves, they're able to suck up water in their bills like a straw, instead of needing to tilt their heads back to let gravity do the work, as all other birds have to do. This may be an adaptation to drink quickly, so they don't get eaten by predators while they're on the ground. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, offering guided nature adventures on Hawaii Island, designed to help inspire connection and stewardship of the land. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
Hawaii Public Radio is here for you and with you through the magic of discovery.
Brian Eno with the song called The Big Ship. I'm Jeff Long. You are listening to Bridging the Gap. My friend Taylor turned me on to that song, and I remember running on those hot Waianae mornings listening to this song and just feeling like I could just handle anything.
Local music shows on HPR are always brought to you with a personal touch.
So I figured this is too good to pass up, so I'm sharing it with you today on Brazilian Experience on HPR 1, and I'm your host, Sandy Tsukiyama.
Support music discovery on Hawaii Public Radio. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
While we have birds on our brain, we turn to a story of hope hatching on Palmyra Atoll. It's where 9 Micronesian kingfishers are nesting. They were hand-raised in mainland zoos because the birds known as sihik, which live on Guam, had not been seen in the wild for almost 4 decades due to the invasion of the brown tree snake. The mostly juvenile birds were moved to the remote atoll where the Nature Conservancy and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife co-manage a research station in the National Wildlife Refuge. Caitlin Andrews is a bird conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy and the Zoological Society of London. She tells us that those birds moved to their new home in September, and they have laid their first eggs.
It's a super exciting milestone. This is the first time that sihik have been in the wild in 36 years. So just seeing them out in the wild and now thriving is a really hopeful moment for the species and the potential to return them to Guam someday.
So talk about how you monitor the birds once you, you know, relocate them.
Sure. We have a field team co-led by the Nature Conservancy and Zoological Society of London that's based out on Palmyra full-time, a staff of 2 with support kind of coming through. And they're out in the field every day tracking these 9 birds. They know each and every individual and their personality. And they're really looking at a number of things. Most importantly, ensuring that these birds survive. So tracking their success and being ready to provide support if the birds need it. Although, thankfully, they've done amazingly well and haven't needed any additional food or support in that way. And they're also trying to learn as much as we can about these birds. It's our first chance to see what wild sihik look like, again, in almost 4 decades. So they're out there essentially recording their voices, narrating everything that the birds do so that we can learn what sihik need to thrive in the wild. And again, with the goal of returning them back to Guam, Palmyra is a really amazing place for us to learn about these birds and kind of refine our translocation strategies that could be used to bring them to other sites in the future.
And these 9 birds, where were they raised?
The eggs came from several different zoos. So there are about 25 association of zoos and aquariums institutions around mainland U.S. and then one facility in Guam that have sihik. And they put in a dedicated effort to raise birds specifically for Palmyra. They sent those eggs to a central facility that we established at Sedgwick County Zoo to make sure that the chicks were reared in really secure conditions away from other species so that they were free of disease, and they were raised by expert zookeepers to make sure they were really ready for this huge transition to the wild.
Where was that facility at?
It was at Sedgwick County Zoo in Wichita, Kansas.
Well, I remember seeing a Micronesian kingfisher at the St. Louis Zoo. I've mentioned this before on the air, but there was an article in the St. Louis Dispatch written by the zoo director, and it was, you know, well written. He just said, "What I have at my zoo is more rare than a Stradivarius." And he just talked about they were doing their part to raise these birds because they could no longer thrive in the environment in Guam because of the invasion of the tree snake. It's a beautiful bird. And it's just really tremendous to think that all these hands played a part in the success of this thriving now in Palmyra.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It's been a really amazing partnership to be part of. Alongside TNC and ZSL, we have Guam Department of Agriculture, our main partners in Guam, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and then again, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And it's truly been a team effort. Everyone brings their own expertise, and everyone shares this vision of helping the species get back to the wild and ultimately back to Guam.
So for our listeners, I guess maybe describe the bird and talk about its behavior and, you know, when we can expect these eggs to hatch.
Sure. So the sea heck is a beautiful turquoise and cinnamon kind of colored kingfisher. So it's a forest bird. It's really unique in that there are only a handful of forest birds native to Guam, and it was only ever found in Guam. So it's really quite a special bird. The eggs that you mentioned, it was a very exciting milestone that we just reached in the project where the first eggs were laid from late March to early April. We had at least three, possibly four pairs of birds make this first breeding attempt. And the birds themselves are still very young. They're all under a year old, apart from one older male. So we don't expect sea hecks this age to successfully hatch chicks, especially on this first attempt. They could surprise us. They've continued to surprise us throughout this process so far. But they really won't reach the mature age where we'd expect them to start having chicks for another few months at least. But the first breeding attempt is great practice for them. It's a pretty amazing process that our field team has had the chance to witness. So sea hecks nest in tree cavities, the holes in trees that they excavate themselves. The male and the female will perch nearby and take turns flying at a soft, kind of dead or decaying tree trunk and hitting it with their beaks to form this cavity that they will nest in. But first, they will excavate 25 or more cavities, as one of our pairs did, and they're really using that time to bond with one another and form a really strong bond, and they'll eventually choose one cavity to nest in. So the field team has been keeping close eye on them. They've seen some amazing behaviors. The male will often feed the female, so he'll bring a food item and present it to her. One of our males, Sindalu, has been honing his skills. He brought his mate, Fwetsa, a cricket, which he was not very impressed by, but then came back with a gecko, which he happily accepted. So they're learning and they're growing, and we're really hopeful that there will be chicks sometime soon.
How big are the eggs?
The eggs are pretty small, so they're in these cavities, which might only be a few inches in diameter, and they usually lay 1 to 3 eggs per nest.
So these eggs may not be viable at this first go-around?
Yeah, perhaps not, and that's based on what we know from zoos. So the sea heck usually start to have viable eggs when they're around 10 to 12 months old. And some of our birds were only around 8 or 9 months when these first eggs were laid. Again, this is all based on the information that we have, and we really don't know what will happen out on Palmyra. We're still holding out hope, but just because there might not be chicks from these first nests, it doesn't mean that it's not a moment to celebrate in the project that the birds are thriving and showing this early interest in breeding.
And then as far as predators on that island, are there any?
There are no introduced predators, no predators of sea heck, and that's why it's really a great place for providing a safe haven for the species. So this is all thanks to decades of restoration work, and I think it's really cool for me to think about the fact that all this work that went into protecting Palmyra, presumably it wasn't done with the intention of providing refuge to a species from Guam, but it just goes to show that the conservation work that we're doing today could have unimaginable benefits in the future. And I think that's something that's really important to keep in mind, given all of the threats to biodiversity that we see around the world.
You know, politically, there is some clawback on programs that fund conservation efforts and, You know, there are proposals for rule changes to natural habitat for endangered species, that kind of thing, or threatened species. Anything else you just want to say about just the success that this program has had?
I think TEHEC are just one of many species that are under threat, and that number is growing and growing. So we need organizations like all of our partners who are doing this on the ground work to protect places and protect species like the CHEC. I think the CHEC provides a really unique story of hope since they were so close to the brink of extinction. They were extinct in the wild for almost 40 years. So it shows that it's never too late for these species, and all of the efforts that we're doing today can help them see the wild again at some point.
That was conservation scientist Caitlin Andrews, who we talked to yesterday. She was highlighting the success of a translocation project on Palmyra Atoll, which is accessible only by private charter. We plan to check in on the progress of the flock of endangered kingfishers from Guam called CHEC, which have not been seen in the wild for 37 years. Well, we are all out of time, but up tomorrow, we plan on keeping an eye on key bills at the state legislature in the waning days. Leave your feedback about our show on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.